we have two people that have literally vanished into the wilderness.
Greg Lynn lost his temper.
I panicked to save myself.
How does a pilot turn into a murderer? I found long-buried secrets simmering just below the surface.
Everyone was scared of him. She was pleading. I thought, this is not good.
Anybody that would kill their wife's pet is a monster.
Huntsman, the latest season of the ABC's true crime podcast, Unravel. Hear Unravel now on the ABC Listen app.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
One of the great Roman emperors, a crippled former slave, a wealthy tutor to the tyrant Nero, and a man who lived in a wine barrel and occasionally urinated on his fellow citizens. These are some of the men whose ideas have caused Bridget Delaney to radically refigure the way she lives her life. Bridget has worked as a lawyer, journalist, screenwriter, and speechwriter. Her writing mines the comedy and the tragedy to be found in all those experiences and whatever else Bridget is encountering in her life. She turned her misadventures in the wellness industry into the book Wellmania, which she then co-created into a Netflix series starring Celeste Barber. But in Bridget's last two books, she's gone on a journey far from colonics and hot yoga, all the way back into the ancient philosophy of Stoicism. Reasons Not to Worry was Bridget's first book on the Stoics. She completed it in the midst of COVID and it became a bestseller. Her new book, The Seeker and the Sage, is a kind of fable, and at its heart is a long conversation between a traumatised journalist and the mayor of a mysterious and remote community, which is run according to the tenets of Stoicism. Hi, Bridget.
Hi, Sarah.
What was the press release that first led you to look into the philosophy of the Stoics?
So it was the foreign editor of Guardian Australia, a friend of mine, Bonnie Malkin, gets press releases from all over the world. And I was doing a column at the time, Bridget Delaney's Diary, which was running in the Guardian. And, you know, each week I would do something different. So I listened to Joe Rogan nonstop for a week. I tried to sleep with my mouth taped shut. I wrote about learning how to drive as an elderly person. And that week there was nothing coming up, and she rescued me by saying, there's a university in the UK that does this thing called Stoic Week, and maybe you could pretend to be a Stoic for a week. So I thought, oh, that sounds like a good premise for a kind of humorous column. And so I went ahead and enrolled.
And what was the promise of this week as a Stoic? What were you meant to be getting out of it?
I think it was learning the basics of Stoicism and then seeing how it was applied. I gave the press release a very kind of cursory glance, I've got to admit, and then enrolled without doing too much deep research. And it was run online, so I joined a community of many thousands of others in learning Stoic teachings.
And when it came for you to write the column up out of that experience, what kind of conclusions had you reached?
Well, I hadn't reached many conclusions. So I was trying to be funny. So, you know, I wrote about how I tried to do the course with a hangover and how I was, you know, always late for the readings and how I couldn't really get what they were saying in some of the threads that were going on in the course. And so I wrote, you know, a fairly offhand piece, and it was published. And then some Stoics, some people who'd done Stoic Week, wrote to me, and they said that it was a real shame that I didn't take it seriously, that Stoicism has a lot to offer, and that it was a real wasted opportunity. So I took that feedback on board, and the following year I did Stoic Week again, not for a column, but just for myself and with a group of friends in Sydney. We had a WhatsApp group, we did the readings together, and at night we would talk about how our day had related to the readings and our understanding of Stoicism. And that was a much more kind of profound experience for me.
When you were first being exposed to these teachings of Stoicism, Bridget, was it an obvious fit for your personality, or were they appealing partly because they were sort of so different to how you'd habitually been approaching things up to that point?
Yeah, definitely the latter. So it was very much at odds with my personality. My personality, particularly in my writing, was someone who was chaotic, a little bit crazy, a little bit impulsive, not always rational. And I leaned into that in my writing. And, you know, that came out a lot in Wellmania and various columns. And Stoicism challenged me to be serious, you know, not as in be humorless, but to take things a bit more seriously, to think a bit more rationally, and to not go so much from my emotional gut instincts, but to introduce a bit more slowness and thought into my actions.
So after this second year of Stoic Week, you decided to dive more deeply into the subject and began a book project in 2019. So let's learn some of the things you got to know in doing that. Where did Stoicism get its start and what part of the world?
Got its start in Greece. There were many schools, you know, in the time. It was like around 350 BC. There were the Epicureans, the Skeptics, the Cynics, and the Stoics. And the Stoics get their name from the word stoa, which is Greek for the porch, the painted porch. And that's where they would meet at the marketplace and discuss philosophy. So I really loved that idea of philosophy being open to people and in a public place, you know, not sort of bound up in the academy. You didn't need to sort of enter a discrete place to learn Stoicism. It was there in the market. So it evolved, you know, in those years, and then went to Rome, where it was very kind of eagerly adopted by the elite in Rome. So a lot of it was mostly men in the kind of Roman Stoic period who learnt Stoicism as training to be a politician or a leader or, you know, in charge of an army.
So it began in Greece, and one of the founders is a now known as a philosopher called Zeno. What had happened to him to get him interested in philosophy?
He got shipwrecked. He had a very expensive cargo. He was carrying dye, which was hugely expensive and important and rare back in those days. So he wound up with kind of no money, no cargo in Athens, and thought he would, you know, use that time that he was stuck there to study philosophy. And he wandered into a bookstore and asked around for a certain philosopher. And then he's like, oh, he's over there. And that's, you know, that's the origin story.
And then once this philosophy makes its way to Rome, who are the main figures associated with it in that period?
So there's three main figures whose work survives. I think there were some brilliant Greek Stoics, but their work only exists now in fragments, which is, you know, really sad. The work we've got that survives today is from Epictetus, the slave that you mentioned in your introduction, Seneca, a brilliant playwright, but also advisor to Nero, and Marcus Aurelius, who listeners would be most familiar with. His book Meditations, which was not intended for publication, is still a worldwide bestseller many thousands of years later. And Meditations was him trying to apply Stoic principles in his journal late at night after, you know, he was on some campaign and he was trying not to be angry and he was trying to love his fellow man. And so his nightly reflections in his journal were his way of teaching himself Stoicism and trying to be Stoic.
I'm terrified at the thought that my nightly journal might somehow thousands of years from now become available for publication. Maybe you're a certain quality of content is more likely to let that happen.
But it's interesting with that journal. It doesn't, you actually don't know much about, he's not speaking personally. Like he's not using the first person so much and he's not talking about situations that happened in his life. Like the Stoic approach to journaling I find really interesting. Like you're not meant to sit there and write, my boss is a horrible person, today they refused me a pay rise and I stormed out and, you know, they are the most kind of pathetic person. It's meant to be, how did I cope with a particular situation? Did I show virtue? Did I show courage and wisdom in a dealing? So the journal is all about your own actions and reactions throughout the day.
Taking stock rather than...
Taking stock and using the journal to improve as a person, it was a tool.
you know, over the centuries since its heyday, Stoicism has become an adjective to describe someone, you know, who's unfeeling or tight-lipped, repressed in some way. How accurate is that for the original meaning?
I don't think it's accurate at all. I mean, you can understand how a word changes over time. But the Stoics, the original Stoics were full of life and feeling and incredibly humorous. Like the writing is very, very funny. And they had a real sort of twinkle in their eyes, you know, in terms of when you read it, you can see the life force flowing through the text. Their thoughts on grief are interesting. Like they don't think you should be desolate and distraught and crying for 3 years post someone dying. They do advocate short, sharp griefs. And I think maybe that's where there was the misunderstanding that it meant no emotion. It's just emotion, but don't let the emotion then take you away from fully living your life. Don't overly suffer if you don't have to.
One of the central things that Stoics are interested in is control, or maybe more accurately, lack of control. According to Stoic thinking, what is there that's actually in our control?
Both a hell of a lot and not very much. They kind of break it down to three main things. Epictetus talked about this in his book, The Enchiridion, and it's called The Dichotomy of Control. And the three main things, as I interpret it, are your character, you're in control of your own character, your reactions and sometimes your actions, not always, and how you treat other people. So those things are within your control. Everything else outside your control. And that includes your health, money, and your reputation. And there's another doctrine, which I often rely on, which is called preferred indifference, which says that those things outside our control, like our health, money, and reputation, are preferable. We would prefer to have them, but we should essentially remain indifferent because they're not fully in our control. So we all know of people who've led very healthy lives, they've got a very healthy lifestyle, and they've still got cancer, they've still got sick, or they've been hit by a car. Stuff outside their control has happened to their bodies, and whilst, you know, we should prefer to be healthy, for our own equilibrium, we should be essentially indifferent.
And when you summarise it like that, I feel a little bit like the journalist in your new book, The Seeker and the Sage, feels, because, okay, on one hand that sounds rational, but wait a minute, what the hell does that mean for how I live my life? Because I'm constantly trying to do things as though I'm in control of them, not just me, but actually other people, even much bigger world events. It seems to run really counter. How has it played out in the way you approach things in your life? Give me an example.
I use it all the time, all the time. So an example might be, say I'm renting a place in Sydney and my landlord did an inspection the other day, first time in 5 years. I thought, oh, what what is going on here? And I realised I'm not actually in control of this property. You know, I can keep it tidy, I can pass the inspection. However, if they want to sell the property, they have control of that, not me. So I need to accept or deal with the reality that I don't necessarily have security in that place. So when the notice does come to vacate, if it does, I have prepared myself emotionally and I'm not suffering twice. The first suffering is being kicked out of my my apartment. The second suffering is the one that I can control, which is devastation that a lease has come to an end and it hasn't been renewed, and anger and then not being, you know, happy in a new place and always looking back on the past and why did that have to end. So the Stoics separated those things out and they said you can do everything you can to try and hang on to the property, but ultimately it's outside your control, and if it doesn't go your way, just move on.
There is a Buddhist idea, the two arrows, which is a very similar one. Like the first arrow you can't control, but all the stuff that you put on about what's happened has got, you have got different agency with. You know, I think the tendency that's a really natural human one to want to try to control our bodies or our circumstances, our situations. It's fueled by fear, you know, that fear that if we let go of at least trying to have control, that we're really exposed and vulnerable.
Mm. The Stoics didn't say don't try. Like, they did not advocate eating whatever you want, getting boozed every night. You know, that was not their message. In fact, one of the four virtues, they talk about virtues a lot, and one of the four main virtues is moderation. So you should eat and drink in moderation. But they said it is within your control to look after your body, but you shouldn't expect to be able to control your body. And they're two sort of separate things. So it's within your control to look after yourself, and there's many reasons, good reasons to look after yourself, including the fact that you're more likely to make rational decisions if your body and your mind is feeling clear.
Is it more than just not identifying with our preferences? Like, did the Stoics actually believe you should sort of try to hunt out situations that are difficult or put yourself deliberately through kinds of hardship?
Absolutely, they did. So Seneca has written, there's a great book, Letters to a Young Man, Letters to Lucilius, which I really love. And that's a kind of dialogue between him and a younger friend. And he talks about voluntary sort of starvation or fasting. He says a couple of days a month, fill your belly with just a kind of small amount of food, rough, dry bread, so that if and when a famine comes, firstly, you're physically prepared, you've trained, and secondly, you won't suffer psychologically because you've had that period of starvation before. It hasn't made you less virtuous or less kind or less wise. It's actually been okay. So we're in an interesting situation at the moment in modern times where everything's frictionless, or we're striving for frictionless experiences where there is absolutely no suffering. And that includes the huge take up of things like Uber, so that you do not have to wait for a bus. You don't have to walk to a bus stop. You know, everything on our phones is designed for ease. And the Stoics, you know, that would be a Stoic's worst nightmare, that the easiness of things. They like a little bit of hardship because they think it trains us for when hardship will eventually come.
So what's that looked like in your life as you've become more interested in these principles? I mean, do you find yourself deliberately making things tricky or giving more friction?
That's the one thing I forget to do. I don't do that. You know, I write about it. It's not a practice I do. It's probably a practice I should do. I love a comfortable bed. You know, I love cooling down when it's too hot and getting warm when it's too cold. And they say, no, be cold when it's too cold and you know, have discomfort. And I think probably for me, my next iteration of Stoicism will be that more physical element, which is the discomfort. I just have to, you know, the old Stoics, the ancient Stoics were very deliberate about, you know, scheduling it, putting it into their lives. You know, Seneca said, set aside a number of days, you know, each month. And that is what I have to do.
Well, it's the seeker and the sage. It's not the sage and the sage. That's
exactly.
I think that's fine. How interested were the Stoics then in happiness, which, you know, still seems to be a big goal for the way lots of us try to organise our lives?
They weren't really interested in that word. They were more into contentment, eudaimonia, ataraxia.
What's ataraxia?
It's equilibrium, it's well-being. It's an old Greek word. It just means chill, you know, chilled out. It's a sort of an emotional homeostasis where you don't go too high, you don't go too low. And in The Seeker and the Sage, the journalist is sent on an assignment by her editor at the start of the book to find the happiest community on earth. And she gets so excited because she knows that everyone's seeking happiness. And this could be a 6-part podcast, possibly a Netflix series in the vein of the Blue Zone series. And so she sees the potentials of exploiting this town that she visits because they have the secret to happiness. And The mayor in the town, the sage, says, look, there is, if you look for happiness, you will not find it, because it is an emotion that is fleeting. It comes and goes. It's often not connected to an external. For example, if you think that you'll be happy if you have a certain car, buy a certain car, you'll be happy for a short period of time. But the hedonic treadmill that has been, you know, very sort of well studied, means that the happiness is very fleeting, and then you want a bigger car or a different car.
So we adjust to whatever our new normal is.
You adjust, and then you. So the discomfort thing that we were talking about earlier is a way of bringing back that, dialing back the hedonic treadmill, so that when you introduce experiences of discomfort, you then reset that treadmill to an extent. I find traveling a really good adjuster for me. I'll often go to countries where the poorest people in that country who don't have anything are the most generous, the most open. And I reset then what I think you need. If you're one person, do you really need a car, an electric bike, and a e-scooter? You know, if you're a family.
And your Uber account.
And your Uber account. Never giving it up.
But, you know, the in terms of emotions and the highs and lows, I think it's also a really common thing that we want to get rid of the lows, but we want to keep the highs, you know. We don't want to be thrown into the fits of despair anymore, but we really love feeling ecstatic and exhilarated. Do you have to lose both if you're going to get this state of equanimity that the Stoics were so in favour of?
I talk a lot about that in Reasons Not to Worry, because when I was writing it, I just got the Netflix deal, which was the most, I was so excited. I was on such a high. But then, you know, later on in the process, there were problems, as there is with any sort of television production. And the lows felt very low in that period of time. And I wonder if, just like in the body, you know, there's an internal mechanism that has to correct, that has to be in balance. The same goes for our emotional life. So you have a really big high. Your brain is pumping out heaps of feel-good chemicals. To get back into that balance that the Greeks were always talking about, it has to then give you a hell of a lot of bad-feeling chemicals in order to get you back into that balance. So the balance isn't sexy. It's not particularly exciting. But I guess for me, that's been the most profound change that Stoicism has wrought, which is, I'm a lot more even tempered these days. You know, I very rarely get angry, and it takes a lot for me to lose my cool, whereas previously I was quite, you know, like a lot of people, I would flare up pretty quickly.
Reactive in a different way. Well, I mean, I guess for that to happen, this idea that that what we're aiming for is a kind of equanimity, that is maybe not the same highs, but they're not the same lows, a sort of feeling of more centeredness or balance. I guess that assumes that reason can direct our emotions a lot more than we might assume it can.
A lot of this, the work that the Stoics did around human nature and emotions, it was before we had neuroscience, before we understood the unconscious or the subconscious, knew about hormones and brain chemistry, all that sort of stuff. So they weren't 100% perfect with their philosophy. However, they got a lot right about human nature. And one of the main things that particularly Seneca writes about is anger. There's a brilliant book that he did called De Ira, a very short book on how to basically tame anger. And it holds up today. And he said you have this when... Say you're driving and a car cuts in front of you and you have to brake really hard. You've got a kid in the back and you're very frightened. That's your first reaction. And then you're angry and you can feel it bubbling up. It's like a volcano. It just comes up in you and then you start the abuse. So they said that is an impression, that feeling that comes up, and that we do have a very slight sort of chance for rationality to creep in before the reaction, before the abuse. So that was what a lot of the philosophy was about, which was saying, we recognize that there's an emotion here. It's anger. It's normal. However, the expression of anger is what causes huge problems down the line. So road rage and assaults and escalation. So if you can stop the anger before it's expressed, you then stop all the chain of incidents that run from that.
Something that strikes me is how often now you see those signs in public places like hospitals or, you know, banks or airports. Please respect our staff. We will not tolerate angry or abusive behaviour. That sense that we're living in a society where anger as a currency has become more and more acceptable.
We're living in angry times, and that's why I think Stoicism is more important than ever, because it is very explicit in its teachings on anger. It had no room for anger. I saw those signs sort of, they started to pop up around kind of post-COVID. And you think, oh God, what have these poor service people gone through? It's often not their fault. We should be angry at systems. We should be angry at the systems that that mean that people aren't getting their needs met, whether they're calling up Centrelink and they're on hold for 5 or 6 hours and then they get someone who can't help them. There will be anger, but the person who's answering the call is not the right target. It's the systems that don't help people that I think we do tend to be angry about. And the Stoics, they didn't necessarily address changing systems. And that's what I look at a lot in my second book, which is, do you need anger in order to change systems, to get more justice in the world? And is it fundamentally un-Stoic to try and reform parts of society?
Bridget, you were talking earlier about the Stoics' attitude towards anger and how it was an emotion that they really had no time for at all. And you raised the question of what that might mean for the role of righteous anger, particularly in terms of social change. Tell me about the Mercy Campaign, the campaign to abolish the death penalty, which you were really involved in at one stage.
Yeah, sure. So I was a member of Reprieve Australia, which has now been, it's now got a new name, which is CPJP. And they do a lot of work. They work out in the US in death penalty states, sending law students to assist on cases. They're now in Asia. And you might recall it was 20 years ago that Van Nguyen was executed, the young Australian guy who was executed in Singapore. And that had a profound impact on me because I studied law. I had been working as a lawyer. I had this principle that the state should not kill. And it just felt like a very distressing thing to happen to someone. So there were some people from Reprieve and we decided we need to look at Southeast Asia. Is there anyone who's at risk there of being executed? Any Australians that we can support? So in 2011, me and a friend, Matt Goldberg, established the Mercy Campaign, working with the families of Myron Sukumaran and Andrew Chan. So they weren't in any imminent danger back then of being executed. They're on death row, but stuff was going through the courts, so it wasn't particularly moving. And so we set up a website. We decided on a petition. We connected, as I said, with the families and the legal team and just thought it would be there just in case, a campaign just in case.
And it certainly turned out to be needed and the whole tragedy of your involvement with that. What was it like to visit those men in prison?
They were really great guys and I really enjoyed meeting them. By that stage, they'd been in Karabakan for quite a while and they'd done a lot of work in the prison to make it a lot more hospitable for everyone. So Myron had an art room. Andrew was involved in the church and he'd established a fellowship in the prison and there was a garden. So I went in with Chin, Myron's brother, and I was surprised at how, not informal, but how we brought food from outside. I remember having a latte or something and a burger or a donut, bringing it in and it was still warm by the time we got to the guys. And
Myron was sitting there listening to, I think he was streaming Radio National and wanted to talk about, you know, Kevin Rudd or something. And so it didn't feel like a big, scary prison. And they did tell me, look, there are parts of the prison that are, that is terrifying, but they'd made it as comfortable as they could.
You spoke about those men and your involvement in that campaign recently as part of a conference on stoicism. What happened?
Oh, that was a live stream in the US, and it was the middle of the night, and it was a couple of hundred Stoics sitting there, and the guy running the conference asked me about the death penalty and my involvement in that case, and they didn't know about Myron and Andrew, they didn't know about the Bali Nine, so I told the story from the start. And then when I got to the part where they were executed in April 2015, I just burst into tears. You know, I'm obviously still holding emotion about that, and it still makes me very sad to this day that happened. And I burst into tears and I thought, this is the worst place to burst into tears at a Stoicism conference. These guys will not take me seriously. I'm going to be ejected from this community which I've just joined. And then I looked down and they were all the attendees were sending me hearts, or these little hearts with a little, you know, bandage on them. And these hundreds of hearts flooded my screen and I, of course, cried even more.
Well, Stoicism doesn't mean no emotion from what
you've
described.
Doesn't mean no emotion, but I think, you know, that was 10 years ago this year and I still have emotion about it. And strictly speaking, I think Seneca may understand, but he would have said, get your tears out, you know, at the time.
You know, your involvement in that campaign happened before you were on this journey into Stoicism and Stoic philosophy. Do you think you would have done any of that differently, handled any of it differently?
The Stoics advise to look reality in the face, to know reality, and also Marcus says to love reality. And I think when you are doing a campaign, you are full of hope. You have to be. And you have to kind of want to bend reality to your will. And when reality doesn't correspond with your hope, it's heartbreaking. That's where the devastation is. You saw that it might be different and then, you know, it wasn't. And the Stoics aren't big into hope because you can't control the outcome of something like an execution, what a government in another country does. It's completely outside your control. And yet I do think, and I've thought about this so much, we need a combination of idealists, you know, flamethrowers in the activist world, and Stoics in government or around government, or also in activism, who can provide that balance, who can look at reality and make rational assessments based on the political situation and the likelihood of something happening. But no, I don't think I would have, I think I still would have done it.
You mentioned earlier that there's a lot of, many parallels between some Buddhist ideas and Stoic philosophy. What about compassion, which is such a big part of Buddhist teaching? Does it have a place, even if it's called by a different Greek name, in Stoicism?
So my interpretation is it doesn't. And I think compassion is, you know, for me it's the highest virtue because it's empathy with a bit of extra. Compassion is transformative. However, the Stoics would say compassion is wanting something for another person, and that is outside your control. So therefore, you shouldn't want it. What I would say, though, is that the Stoics, and one reason I love them, is that they weren't fundamentalist or like intensely doctrinal. They were, like Seneca said, people will come after us and there'll be new discoveries and new things to add. You know, it's not a rigid system, and it's quite a forgiving, I feel like it's quite a forgiving philosophy. But, you know,
They would have said compassion. No, it doesn't. We can't really see where this fits. They gave a lot of thought to death, both the reality of their own death and the death of the people they loved. What exercises did the Stoics recommend for preparing us for death?
Got to do a trigger warning here because a lot of people find this really harsh. But Epictetus used to say, look at your child before you put them to sleep and imagine that they die in the night and they're like unalive in the morning. And that is difficult for a lot of people to bear, but it is. There is a poem, a Christian poem, Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep, I Pray the Lord My Soul to Keep. And if I die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. So that thing of imagining death overnight and not being around the next day is embedded in Christianity, but it's fallen very much out of favour. And I think, look, there was a high level of infant mortality in ancient times. Marcus, I think, lost 7 of his children, and you needed to be able to get up in the morning and move on. You know, you couldn't be stuck in grief for your whole life. So the philosophy, in a way, had to prepare people for death, for their own death, the death of their friends and the death of their children. And they did that by asking you to imagine quite frequently, but not for prolonged periods of time, the death of people closest to you.
It is, of course, by definition, an awful thing to imagine, to contemplate the death of someone you love, particularly the death of a child, because it feels to go so against the order of things. I wonder if it also, if it can risk putting a kind of distance between you and who you love. It's like, oh, if I have to face that, I'd rather be withdrawn a little bit. So it's interesting that Marcus Aurelius had the line to love life. So it's not withdrawing from the people we love, but going towards them with this awareness that at any point any of us might not be here tomorrow morning.
Absolutely. I mean, I think what they saw, they were so wise, they were so amazing. What they saw is that you can be kind of a bit casual about friendships or about family. You can say, I'll catch up with them next year. I'm too busy. I'll see that person another time. My parents live interstate. You know, I do think about it with them. They're in their 70s. I just think, okay, I'll go and see them. This could be the last time. And it brings you towards someone. It doesn't make you pull away. And also, when you are going towards them and you are spending time with them and you have in mind this could be the last time, they talk about whether or not it's a friendship ending or the death of a friend. So you're far more wholehearted in that interaction. You're far more likely to squeeze the joy out of it rather than being on your phone. Stoics would have hated phones. You know, it pulls you away from people. Yeah, so it has a couple of protective properties, one of which is you spend more time with the people you love. And secondly, if they do happen to die or you never see them again, you're not feeling guilty that you didn't enjoy them while they were here.
So those exercises, that exercise is kind of building a muscle ready for an inevitability. Have you seen those Stoic ideas helpful to someone who's actually in the midst of that reality, who is grieving the loss of someone close to them? How does that sound to modern ears, do you think?
It doesn't sound great. I've tried it.
Tried it under advisement.
Doesn't sound great. I haven't gone through that yet, and I will go through it. We all will. But you're going for a walk with a friend who's lost someone really close to them, and then you suddenly pull out your stoicism and say, look, they're gone. You have your short period of grief. And it's a terrible thing for people to hear, and I have to be careful using it. But it's also a good counterpoint. You know, there's so much in our culture that is about making people comfortable for long periods of time. And that actually could be harmful. If someone's, you know, if you're feeling sad and you're grieving and someone says, okay, we'll give you a year off to grieve, is that necessarily going to help that person? Or will being in the flow of life in the day-to-day be more useful?
Has immersing yourself in these ancient philosophies made you think about your own death more directly?
Yeah, I do think about my own death relatively frequently. I had a near-death experience in Barcelona. I was assaulted and
got a wound to my right temple. Still have a massive scar there. And I remember being in an ambulance on the way to hospital and feeling quite sure that that was it. And the feeling that I had was of absolute peace. I was, I think, 29 years old, still had a lot of life in front of me, but it wasn't scary. And I've kind of held that as an experience, as a kind of really comforting experience that when it happens, it's okay. The Stoics believe that they talk about being returned, you know, that when we die, they don't talk about heaven. There's no kind of heaven in Stoicism or afterlife, but this return to the elements, return to the material world. They're extremely aware of nature and our part of nature's cycle. And that to me is a comforting thing.
Some of the things the Stoics wrestled with were on a smaller scale, but still very relatable in our own lives, like how much alcohol to drink.
Yeah.
What was the Stoic take on that?
That was so funny with alcohol. This is why I love them, because I think they're just like us. You know, how many people do dry January, dry July, Feb fast? Like, we're always trying to grapple with consumption, and so were they. And they had so much writing on this topic. It was quite funny. So Epictetus is like, he's writing about like when you're at a banquet and the wine comes over, and we all know what that's like. You're at a party and the tray.
Like everyone's comes Christmas over. Work party or family event is front of mind, yes.
And it's maybe it's really good champagne and you...
Not at my work party, but yes, sorry, others.
And you go to stick your hand out to grab a glass, and he says, no, you've got to get practiced at letting the glass pass and drinking water, which is... You're not drinking alcohol. You're not drinking because you've hidden every bottle in the house. You're not drinking when you're surrounded by it. And he said, that's what we need to get to, is this thing of it's there. You are perfectly comfortable and relaxed in an environment that is a big party, but you don't have to partake because your rational mind is too important to you to kind of compromise. Seneca, though, had this great line where he talked about moderation, don't drink or don't drink much, but then every now and again get absolutely wasted. He says sometimes the only thing that can dislodge, you know, pain or whatever is to wash it with wine. And that is all about, like, and I'm sure everyone's had this situation where you're in the doldrums, maybe you've just been dumped and you're just sitting at home in your pajamas and one of your friends says, come on, let's just go clubbing or whatever and let's just have a big night. And you have one huge night and you're kind of a new person the next day because it's gotten you out of a funk. So that was their asterisk.
In case you're allowed to.
Break glass.
You're having to work with Nero on a day-to-day basis. Sure, go to town now and again at the banquet. The reality of phones in our lives, not something that the Stoics had to grapple with. And it does, from what you're saying, feel they'd have some pretty harsh things to say about how much control we've given to them in our day-to-day lives. What did the Stoics advise around time and how we spend time? Because I think that's such the big experience for me of just how much time I must have had before I had an iPhone that I was doing something else with that I'm not doing anymore.
Mm. So they said we treat money the way that we should treat time. So Seneca says this, you know, we're cautious about money. Like we'll be like, no, I'm not going to get the nicer Airbnb accommodation because I'm trying to save $100. But yet we fritter away time as if we have endless expanses of it. We're 5 hours a day on the phone or 4 hours a day on your phone. And he says, you can always get money back. Money will come and go. Time is the one thing you can't get back. And they just thought we were very wrong-headed about it back then. Now I'm sure they'd be.
What were they spending their time on, those Stoics, instead of what was
they
how
were
they frittering
to each
time?
Other? They were developing these amazing philosophies that are still relevant.
So a good use of time.
They were thinking, they were reading, they'd go to the gym, they'd hang out with their friends, they'd go to banquets. Seneca was incredibly prolific, like he wrote amazing plays, some of which are performed today, like Thyestes is a great example. I saw that at Belvoir a few years ago. And, you know, his political advisor, they'd be traveling maybe down to their summer houses. They grew grapes. They filled in time. But they did also talk about, like Seneca writes about, don't brag about being busy. Like being busy is not, it's kind of a refuge of someone who is not in control of their time. And it's also a way of signaling self-importance. So he cautioned against busyness even back then.
Some of what you're describing has crossover with the things you looked at in Wellmania, like how much champagne should I be drinking? How should I be spending my time? When do I go to the gym? What's good for me? Where do you see the parallels between this world of stoicism and your earlier deep dive into that wellness industry?
I think everyone wants to live a life where they are physically comfortable in terms of they're not suffering. And they're emotionally not suffering, that the people around them are well and happy, and that at the end of their lives they can look back and say, that was a good life. The Stoics approached that through philosophy. In the wellness industry, where I find the sadness of the wellness industry is that it's trying to give us answers to those questions, but it's packaging it up in products that you then need to buy. And when that product is exhausted, you then have to buy another product, and no product really works for very long. Whereas Stoicism, it's completely free. Anyone can pick up a book, a library book, and read about it or form a group with their friends to discuss Stoic principles. It's not like a church where there's money attached and there's a building and there's a hierarchy. I think it's a way of living that is outside the market that's been profoundly useful in my life. And the wellness industry is a sort of corrupted form of that. I don't know if it has sort of the intellectual nuance. It definitely does not have the intellectual nuance of Stoicism.
Let me rephrase that.
But I guess I would say one thing I'm really in favour of is people not being afraid of philosophy, of not feeling like they can't enter that church, you know, of books and great philosophers, particularly the Greeks and Romans, because there's a feeling of intellectually they haven't passed some entrance exam. That's not what the Stoics wanted. You know, this is something that is very easy to understand.
As you said, they were a group of people standing around under a porch during the day talking about ideas. It wasn't something that was locked away in its origin. Explain to me or unpack for me a little how you make the leap or how a Stoic might make the leap from reading about these ideas, talking about them, thinking, yeah, that's really correct. I don't have the control I think I do. Or yes, I do let anger overpower my reason at certain points. Yes, I want to spend less time on my phone or with a hangover. But how do Stoics suggest you make the leap from understanding things like that intellectually and actually living them?
It's like what religion is. You know, I grew up Catholic. Religion is every single week you go to Mass and you have the book of that religion read to you, and then you go to a school where it's taught to you. And so it's drummed in, and by the time you're 18 and you've received all the sacraments and you've been to a religious school, it's embedded. Now, Stoicism doesn't have that system, so you have to be self-directed. That's where the journaling is really important. So I would say that you read the big three, Epictetus, Aurelius and Seneca, and you read adjacent texts, you join, you know, there's some great groups online that meet and discuss Stoicism. You find a group, you watch YouTube videos. I mean, that's the one good thing about technology is that we can connect and really like spread the word via videos and online groups. And then you know, in your journal at night when you're doing an account of your affairs of the day, you're asking yourself, did I practice Stoicism the right way today? It's similar to the Jesuit thing of looking back and making an account of your day. So you don't keep a diary at the start of the day about what you want to do. You keep a diary at the end as to what you've done, and were you virtuous? And the four virtues for Stoicism are courage, justice, wisdom, and temperance. Did you exercise those four things today?
Does meditation have a place in Stoic philosophy? Were they into that, or it was more the talking and the thinking?
It's more the talking and the thinking. I use meditation as part of my Stoic practice. So I do Vedic meditation, which is 20 minutes a day, twice a day, and I find that's a good adjunct to the the theory of Stoicism because the meditation brings me into a relaxed state of ataraxia. So I'm much more or I'm much less inclined to be reactive when I've been meditating. And then the Stoicism is kind of undergirds that.
If you hadn't been sent that press release about Stoic Week by your newspaper editor back in the day, Bridget, how might you be a different person today, do you think? How might your life look different from the outside?
I mean, that's impossible to say because, I mean, the Stoics do talk a lot about fate, which is what has happened has happened. You know, there would have been no other path. It was always going to happen. I'm not sure I completely believe in fate, but I haven't thought about what it would be like if I didn't find it. I think I would have found something. I was headed in that direction. I've always been interested in meaning and how we make life more meaningful and also how we suffer less. And yeah, if I hadn't found Stoicism, I probably would have found something similar.
Bridget, it's absolutely fascinating to read your books and talk to you about this subject. Thank you so much for being my
guest. Thank you so much, Sarah. That was great.
Bridget Delaney's most recent book is a novel exploring Stoicism, and it's called The Seeker and the Sage. Her earlier introduction to Stoic philosophy is called Reasons Not to Worry. This Conversations was produced on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.